Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast, a mailbag episode. This is maybe a safe place. Welcome to Miss Apex Mailbag. I'm your host, Antonia Rankin, and this week we are addressing your questions and comments from our inbox. So thank you to everyone that's got in touch, and you can do so yourself using our email address, which is feedback@missedapex.net. So let's kick off by answering some of your questions. But before we do so, I am being instructed to remind you that we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind support of our patrons and advertising partners. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, and quite frequently are, but we're first. We have an international panel to help answer all of your questions this week. So, live from Jazz Bar in Manhattan, probably, it's Matt.
You know, if they built a wall directly across the track, it would solve all track limits for all time.
Sounding very American with the building of a wall. And joining us from a Copenhagen nightclub, spinning the decks, is DJ Christian Pedersen. Hi, how you doing?
For pronouncing my surname correctly for the first time on the podcast.
Yeah, what's this I hear? Apparently Spanners has been dropping the ball.
I'm as surprised as you are.
Shocking. See, you guys, this is why I'm the objectively better host. And of course, our Miss Apex favourite, or at least one of my favourites, joining us from a dank smoky pub in Crawley is Chris Stevens.
In Crawley? You think I'm that posh? No way.
I wish I knew where Crawley was. I probably couldn't point it out on a map blindfolded.
I mean, but it is not far from me. It's about a half hour drive from me. But no, I would never be considered that posh. And can I just take a second and brag about myself for a moment? Because I've lost 10 kilos. I've lost 10 kilos.
Wow, 10 kilos?
And I feel like I look flipping fantastic right now. So I'm really glad that all you YouTube watchers out there, if you're not watching the podcast, then you should be at Missed Apex F1 on YouTube. Check me out because I look fantastic.
Everyone who's listening to the recorded show, you really are missing out here because Chris does look absolutely phenomenal. Edible even. Those 10 kilos just slid right off. Anyway, without any more self-promo or shameless flattery, let's get on to the mailbag. So, first up, we have Justin's email, and Justin has been wondering what makes a driver memorable, what makes them go down in history. Now, I'm going to admit, I'm 20 years old, so as much of the F1 world I can remember, probably earliest I can remember is Jenson Button's Braun era, and I have to say, what a golden era that was. Everyone has a favourite James Bond, don't they? Whether it's Pierce Brosnan or Daniel Craig, he's my version of that. He's my favourite Bond of the paddock. But he has asked, Justin has asked, do you feel there are any current or recent drivers who are pretty good, but they'll be mostly forgotten in the next decade or two? He's always felt that Ralf Schumacher, despite not being the best Schumacher to ever drive a Formula One car, although certainly not the worst, doesn't find his way into many conversations. And he's saying that even though his stats are comparable to Ricciardo's, so 6 wins, 27 podiums, various decent successes, I feel due to his charisma and media attention throughout his career, Danny Ric will continue to be talked about long after he's retired, whereas Ralf Schumacher has fallen into relative obscurity. Now, he makes a good point here, Justin, in that there are a lot of drivers on the grid right now who I personally would say are pretty good drivers who have promising racing careers in front of them, but they might not go down in history. So, Chris, what do you think?
I think it's a lot different now compared to, say, when Ralf Schumacher was driving, just because of the sheer growth of the sport itself, and therefore the knowledge of not just the headline players, let's say, you know, the fact that Drive to Survive, especially for the first season or two, got to focus more on the midfielders than the, you know, than the Mercedes and the Red Bulls of the sport. They suddenly are put to the forefront, and there's a lot more depth of knowledge of all the drivers across the field, I feel, and rather just the than just the top liners. But I feel like what really helps as well is being part of big moments in history, right? So
absolutely.
Ricardo Zonta is only remembered for being driven by both Mika Häkkinen and Michael Schumacher at the same time on the run into Lake Om in the 2000 Belgian Grand Prix. I don't think 99.9% of Formula One fans could name another Ricardo Zonta moment or anything else he actually did in his career. So I feel like that's something that helps.
Well, I have to say, I completely agree. I do think there's something about social media and, like you said, Drive to Survive that really immortalizes these drivers and makes them into characters more so than just, you know, F1 drivers who maybe have one or two seasons. I think one who doesn't get talked about enough for me is Rubens Barrichello. Again, going back to the Braun era, but a great driver. And where is he now? Nobody knows. I mean, Christian, would you say you agree? Do you think that social media plays into it a lot?
Definitely does, but I think we as consumers, we need to put a name on it. We need to put a color on it or something like that. And if someone has a brother, if someone has a dad, or we just put them in a different light. And I remember the initial question, we didn't read all of it out loud, but it mentioned Ralf Schumacher compared to his brother. And there was a big reason for Ralf Schumacher not being as famous as his brother. And that was his work ethics, his way of socializing, how he embraced the team. Ralf Schumacher didn't have any of that. They had the same mother, but they're not the same person. So I think the way we look at the driver somehow, sometimes they become more the poster on the side of the wall than actual human beings. And I think that's always been a thing, right?
No, absolutely, Matt.
Well, I hate to disagree with everybody about everything at the very start of the show.
No, you don't. You love to disagree. My word. Go on anyway.
I'm going to go the opposite direction here. I think due to how rapidly the social media cycle turns over, I think it's going to be a much bigger deal because there were fewer races, fewer drivers back then. And I will be the first to admit, you don't have to go back very long before you run into drivers who've won races that no one or people will be like, oh, what? Me? Huh? Who? But I think if we're talking about drivers from this era, I think Schumacher's memory, Ralf, that is, has probably already lasted far longer than Ricciardo's, unless he goes on to some kind of other fame, like commentating or something like that, post Formula One. And I mean, just I'll throw it out there. Verstappen, Hamilton, Alonso, and that's pretty much it of the drivers driving right now, unless someone goes on to win a driver's championship. In that case, they might be remembered longer.
I would slightly disagree with that, Matt, because Ricciardo, for me, is kind of a poster boy for Formula One. You see, he's just been on, Is it Letterman or one of those types of shows in America? He's done pretty much all of them in promoting F1, whether it's the US Grand Prix or the Las Vegas Grand Prix this week as well. You know, he's basically the F1 poster boy and probably the most universally popular driver in Formula One. And he's also had some pretty mega wins to his name as well. When you think about Ricciardo wins, they have normally come in adverse conditions, right? So the Hungary one in 2014 is particularly memorable when you had him, Hamilton, and Alonso fighting for the win. Of course, you've got the big Monaco disappointment and then the Monaco redemption 2 years later as well. I think that those stories, especially coming in the time that they have done, is easily going to outlive his time in Formula 1. It's not like, what happened? As soon as he got dropped at the end of last year, whatever it was, all the tweets are, get Ricciardo back in Formula 1. And sure enough, the second that De Vries is under-delivering and we want more of a marketing tool in the AlphaTauri, they ship in Ricciardo. And he's going to be way more of a popular choice in terms of a marketability point of view than I think any other driver in the grid.
Yeah, I will say though, it's Ricciardo, obviously, like you said, he's got some fantastic race wins to his name. And because he's such a big personality, I don't doubt that he'll be around the paddock, even if he isn't in F1 in years to come. But even winning races, etc., doesn't necessarily, as we all know, stamp your name in F1 history. But I wouldn't even say that winning championships does. I mean, I've got, this is such a random F1 fan thing about myself, I've got a picture of every single F1 world champion who has ever been. And some of them I've gone through and I go, I've never heard that name in my life. You know, these men once dominated the sport in their own eras, and I still don't know who they are.
Yeah, well, and I think you're right. And I think as much as Ricciardo is the flavor of the moment-ish, although plenty of people now know him mainly as having lost to Norris two straight years at McLaren, I would happily wager some very small sum of money, enough to pay for your favorite drink at your local, that if we talk about drivers out of this era that are most remembered that aren't Verstappen, Hamilton, and Alonso, it's going to be Grosjean, because they're going to show that crash forever on TV. So if you want to be known, it's either going to be in an incident like that. Now, I know you think I'm joking, but I'm also kind of serious about it. You have to do something like, you either come to attention doing something like that, or you win all the races and the championships. And people in between, in a decade or two, they'll be there. People who were fans of the sport will probably go back and learn something about them, or they'll come up from time to time. But they're not going to be day-to-day names in the way that those other three drivers are.
If you think of drivers like the Sunter incidents and stuff like that, they are what I would compare to, let's say, Barbie girls or Informer with Snow. They are one-hit wonders and they break through. It's instant. Everyone talks about it and then they're gone again. What I see Daniel Ricciardo doing is doing great albums. He's a great person. I mean, the world is hungry for good persons, personalities, people being empathetic and stuff like that. Smiles, teeth. It's just something that works on humans. And I know from if I was at a F1 party, I would go to the room where Daniel Ricciardo is.
I think we all would, wouldn't we? Yeah. I mean, like Justin said, he's got the charisma, he's got the media attention. But I'm going to disagree with Matt's point here. Someone like Grosjean, for example, because whilst I'm sure all of us have kind of war trauma flashbacks to the eras of Grosjean crashing in pit lanes and spinning every 5 minutes, I don't think we remember Grosjean for who he is as a driver or from that incident, for example. You just remember the fact of the incident and the fact of how crazy and shocking it was. You know, if someone's coming to the sport in the future and they've not watched Grosjean, but they've seen the crash, they don't remember him and they don't remember him as a driver. They remember the fireball, Chris.
I think you're absolutely right, because they'll remember the incident, but they won't remember Roman specifically. And I feel like it's the same with Spa 2012, when he flew over the top of Alonso and nearly took his head off, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone remembers the moment, right? Mm-hmm. And I think people even go as far as thinking how that affected the championship. It was a very rare DNF for Fernando Alonso that mm-hmm. year, Alonso being one of the more talked about drivers of the sport. I suppose the interesting question to follow up on this, would Nico Hülkenberg be remembered as the guy who never got a podium or choked podium opportunities in Formula One? Because that's going to keep coming up at races.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't want to think about Nico Hülkenberg being forgotten because I really like him. He's really lovely. And I guess kind of like you said, he's remembered and talked about in a fond way because everyone kind of feels for him that he's not got the podium that we all kind of want him to get, you know, the super sub of F1, if you will. But I don't know. I think there's various ways one can go down in history in F1. I mean, crashes, yeah, fair enough. I'll take Matt's point on that one. I specifically remember one with, I think, Mark Webber becoming airborne and literally flying through
Valencia.
The air. Yeah, there we go. Literally straight into a barrier. He believed he could fly, and fly he did. But I think in terms of actually making a meaningful impact on the sport, I think you've got to have something about you, don't you, Christian?
I think if you ask Timo Glock what he's asked most about, for instance, that would be like the Brazil incident, right? But he's a very, very talented racing driver. He's been mm-hmm. in numerous series. And he probably hates that question. But I also think if you ask him when he's 80, if mm-hmm. he still hates the question, he will be like, well, it just became part of my racing career. And at least mm-hmm. someone talked to me or talked about something with my name. So it's a bit give and take. But I don't think the drivers like Sunta is, I don't think at first they want to be known for the incident. They want to be known for their own overtakes and stuff, of course.
Of course, you want to be remembered for the good things. But as someone mentioned earlier, I don't think there's any such thing necessarily as good or bad press once your career's over. You just want to be remembered. You want to go down in F1 history. I mean, it's
NASA
why the
is perfect example of that.
No, exactly. You know what? He was an exact example I was thinking of because before the whole, incident with the championship, and now he's coming back up, bringing it all back up because he was sat in bed one night thinking about it for too long and started overthinking and butt-dialed his lawyer. I, to be honest, was kind of forgetting about him. I mean, I remember him having, a really nasty head injury at one point, and then there was the issue with the championship, and off he's gone. He kind of commentated sometimes, and now he's trying to get back into the popular common conversations, Chris.
Well, see, my defining Timo Glock memory, to be cool and, you know, not like pick the same one that everyone else did, you know, is when he called Mercedes beeping idiots for quitting DTM.
What a lovely memory. I'm sure he'd really appreciate having a discussion with you about that one.
Yeah, sure. But it's amazing.
Like you said, they just want to have a... I'm sure if you sit down with most ex-F1 drivers, they'd probably just appreciate you remembering any defining moments of their career, especially if it's 5-10 years in the future.
So not to go straight from talking about Timo Glock to drivers who were absolutely terrible, because the two are not linked.
Oh, no. Good transition
because,
there.
Because the live chat has reminded me of certain drivers.
What have they dug up? Go on.
So Taki Inu, and I'm sure, I can't remember his first name, but Nissany Senior, Roy Nissany's dad. And I'm sure, you know, as much as it pains me to say it, people are going to talk about Nicholas Latifi in that way as well, my boy.
You mean Gotifi? Put some respect on his name, please.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. Things like that for being, but again, for all the wrong reasons, for being mm-hmm, particularly mm-hmm. bad and always, and, you know, Grosjean had the same kind of reputation where he was always running into people. So did Maldonado as well. I think, like, what is the first Pastor Maldonado memory you think of? Is it when he got distracted by his own steering wheel and drove off the circuit and into a wall? Or is it when he won the Spanish Grand Prix? Or is it when he did something else really stupid? There's a big variety with Pastor, which is great.
Yeah.
Well, okay, if we look back on the last 10 years then or so of F1 drivers who have won races, you're right. How many of them do we actually go? Because I can't say I ever sit very commonly and think about Maldonado. You know, he doesn't work his way into my daydreaming. So if we look back at the last however many years at race winners, Matt, who would we remember?
Well, I like this. How about we play it like a little game? I'll start reading names about a decade back.
Okay.
And I'll skip the ones you've already mentioned because you've already blown a couple, quite frankly. And I'll ignore the fact that the chat is telling me that Maldonado has more wins than Norris right now.
Ouch. And I'm
well, I mean, again. Okay, so Maldonado, Barrichello, Massa.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, here's the first one. And we're going back to about 2008 now.
Okay, so do we stop you when there's one who we
stop me when I say a name and you're like, oh, okay. There's a name I haven't thought about in a while.
I'm
trusting you to be honest. And by you, I mean you, because I know I can't trust Chris and Christian. Well, he just looks like trouble, so.
Okay, right. My integrity is, of course, infallible. Right, let's go. Who do I not remember? Bear in mind, can we just say for the listeners, I was probably about 3 years old when some of these people won, so give me some grace.
It is absolutely fine. Just the first name I get to and you're like, haven't thought about it, let me know.
Got you. Let's go.
Heikki Kovalainen.
Kovalainen, yeah.
Maybe. Should I go back a little further?
Yeah.
All right. I'm gonna skip Robert Kubica because he was a more recent conversation.
Yeah, yeah. I remember him.
Well, and Robert's also more active in like modern racing because Heikki's just been in Japan for the last what feels like 50 years.
Yeah. All right. Are we ready for the next one?
Okay, keep going, keep going.
Giancarlo Fisichella.
I knew someone was going to bring up Fisichella in this.
There we go. Bingo. That's 2006.
Okay, yeah, that would explain why I was literally 3 years old.
That's exactly how far back you have to go. And we're talking 3 wins, a good driver, very well respected, a long career, 1996 to 2009. But not so memorable.
Not, yeah.
And I think for the vast majority of the grid right now, this will be their fate.
He's memorable, I think, for like a couple of the standout performances in 2009 as well. Like when Force India suddenly turned up at Spa and would have won that race if they had Kurs, for example, because they just couldn't get past Kimi Raikkonen, who had the Kurs at the time. This was before it was on all the cars. When it was in its first year of development. So things like that, because he suddenly went on this mad streak. Didn't he also drive for Ferrari that year as well? And suddenly was like one of the worst decisions he ever made because he went from fighting for podiums to suddenly right down the back of the grid in a far inferior car.
That seems a common mistake for drivers, doesn't it? Poor Sebastian didn't learn a lesson there, did he?
But
we're proving Matt's point here, though. We're proving his point. If the only reason you think about a driver is like, who is somebody that I've forgotten about? You know, it speaks for itself. If the only reason you've thought about him is because you were like, oh, I knew he'd come up in a conversation about drivers who have become irrelevant and no one really thinks about anymore. You know, but it's so brutal to say it that way, isn't it? These drivers who have had successful Formula One careers who have kind of just been lost to history. Chris?
Well, so I know we've only had like 3 world champions in the last 15 years, but Nico Rosberg is probably one of the least talked about like recent drivers, and bearing in mind he's tried to maintain a pretty you know, not in your face career, but you know,
he's there
doing YouTube, he's still doing Sky appearances, he's doing all these different things, and yet
he's not getting vaccinated.
Allegedly, Antonia, allegedly. You know, we don't actually talk so much, unless it's only ever really in the context of Lewis Hamilton, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and it's always Nico on the commentary going, well, when I raced Lewis, and then some slight dig at Lewis.
I'd rather hear about when he was teammates with Michael Schumacher.
Christian, do you ever find yourself thinking about Rosberg, longing for the days of a competitive championship where it was quite literally neck and neck, Tom and Jerry style?
I think actually it was really impressive what he did.
I agree.
And I find it psychologically being quite the performance that year, more than maybe perhaps the driving, because she's always been a great driver. And I think he handles himself pretty good. If you think about who he is, like he's the Don Johnson of our era, the way he's dressed, his lifestyle, he's... To people who doesn't know Don Johnson, he was one of the police officers in Miami Vice, which was a series in the 80s where everyone was wearing like Miami colors, Miami Vice. He could so easily be the target of all the criticisms in the world, right? But he still just, I think he handles himself so perfectly. I saw him recently talk about Lando Norris and his sort of mental side and approach to Formula One. And he was like, oh, I was thinking about texting him because I have a guy who can help him. I just like, I think he's a good person inside, actually.
Yeah, I agree.
He did beat Lewis Hamilton, right? I mean,
well, yeah, and then immediately went, mic drop, off I go.
I would have done the same, I think.
Yeah, I agree, Matt.
Yeah, well, at the end of the day, if you want to be known beyond your Formula One career and you don't win championships, you're going to have to become a commentator or move on to some other media that keeps you known for that. I mean, if you think back.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Villeneuve is perhaps a great example. I was thinking, or maybe have someone make a film about you, like Rush. How many people really remembered much about James Hunt or Niki Lauda pre-Mercedes before that film got made? And then everybody knew about them all over again. So yeah, maybe there will be a happy second life for some lucky racers down the road somewhere in entertainment land.
The live chat has just reminded me of a great one. Remember, you can join the live chat if you support us on Patreon. Wink.
Nice,
Tim Rudd, one. Waffle Stoffel Van Dorn. And this astonishes me because... because he's a Formula E world champion. He's a Le Mans racer. He's done a lot since he left F1. And personally, it's kind of faded into obscurity. I have paid less attention to Formula E this year, it must be said. But that also being said, didn't have a great year in 2023. So that's probably something to do with it as well.
I think we've had some very quality discussions here. So to summarize, Justin, thank you for sending in your question. You have to have something about you, and some drivers, it seems, just don't have that. So Justin ended his message by saying, as always, thank you for all you do to remain independent, though I am pulling for you to get some of that Stroll money someday. As are we, Justin, and you two can assist in us becoming and staying independent because we are supported at patreon.com/missedapex.
So I think the next thing we should really talk about is the thing that is most broken in Formula One. And that, of course, is qualifying because, and I've made this argument before, qualifying is just mostly boring. It's just cars driving around. It's a mess. And Sam Parker has written in to agree with me. Well done, Sam. And he says, why does the qualifying format get such good press when it's boring to watch? You never see the cars driving. You get one driver completing a lap on board, and that's it. After that, just cars going around the last corner and random times being shouted with no one having any idea who's going to wind up where. So this, to me, sounds like a comms problem. So let's ask Chris Stevens his opinion first.
So to me, this is a limitation of broadcasting, right? Because it's not the format's fault, is it? Unless you did a one-shot quali where... everybody gets the whole track dedicated to themselves, which Formula One did used to have, but it has its own downsides. For example, it means that the track is going to be at different states for all the drivers. So effectively, whoever you put out last is going to get the best track conditions. So that's not always considered the way to go. For me, this is a broadcasting issue where I don't think we see enough of, you know, multi-camera views where, you know, we could follow this guy in one corner and somebody else. And you know, there is the technology to do that. Now, if you're using like a multi-viewer, for example, then I'm sure you absolutely love qualifying because you've got all the views out of everyone. So I think it's kind of been narrowed in by the broadcasters.
I totally agree with the premise of the question. I love the old qualifying format, as Chris just talked about, and the reason for that is, of course, I'm from a TV brain. When I watch that, you have 20 stories to tell during qualifying. And it's so intense, and it's, I don't know how they start, if it's how they finished last race, whatever. You follow the car around the last corner, and then you're on board all the time. Maybe see it from outboard as well, but you're still, the story is this one lap. And when you can tell the story like that, you have a much better presentation on TV, and people will immediately understand how important it is, the drama, etc. But I also agree with the fact when you watch one of these qualifying sessions and your favorite driver goes out when it starts raining at the end of the session, you're like, what? That's unfair. So from a sporting point of view, you can't really do that. One thing I do liked was the thing they did during sprints where Q1 was hard tire, Q2 was medium, Q3 was soft for all cars, and it was mandatory. That probably could do a little bit of thing. Some cars wouldn't like the hard tire, something like that.
Yeah, it does highlight the differences between cars, especially, for example, on the Ferraris, where they struggle to light up those hard tires. But it does take out, and it takes out that element of strategy on a quali, where you see cars coming out on maybe a scrub set of mediums and good as a fresh soft.
So the thing, first of all, I want to give some hope to Sam. It is possible, as has been said, to make qualifying better for yourself. The things you're going to need are the following. You're going to need a live timing screen, and you're going to need a track map so that when you see, and to me, this is the thing I find that broadcasts miss out the most, is the order they go out in is the order you need to be watching. And that while it's exciting to focus on Max going faster than everyone in the last session of Q1, the real story is who is going to get cut. So you need to be looking at who's in the drop zone, who's very likely, like, say, for example, we have a Red Bull in the drop zone. That's pretty much not worth paying attention to unless they get halfway through their lap and they're not getting better for whatever reason. But if you're paying attention to the order they go out in, then you know who's left on track to possibly knock people out. And I do feel like, and I do watch F1 TV, so maybe Sky is better or different about this, but I do feel like the art of being able to pitch that as it's happening is getting a little bit more lost in these more modern times than I recall it being in earlier times. Though I was more soft-brained in earlier times, so who knows if I'm remembering it accurately or not. But Chris, I mean, truly, as a commentator, I just want your opinion now. Have you had to call any qualies that are similar to this Formula One format? And if so, like, how would you prepare for that?
I've not done a dropout one. The one that we have in the GT Open and the support series that I commentate on is that it's just a 30-minute or 20-minute, whatever it is, session, and you just do whatever the best time that you can in that amount of time. And that usually comes down to, it normally plays out quite similar to just a quali session, like be it Q3 or whatever, where they go out on two sets of tires and try and get that time in, which, and again, usually comes towards the end of the session anyway, particularly because it's usually very early in the morning, so the track starts out normally pretty cold and also very green, so it gets warmer as the sort of session goes on.
Can I just add a few things about the timing, live timing app experience? Because actually, if you want to find qualifying entertaining, you can just do with the live timing app. You don't even need like a Formula One F1 TV Pro. You can just buy the small subscription package and download the white with red logo app. And in there, you have the old style timing screens, the ones they used before Liberty, more or less. It's a bit updated. But actually, that's the best one of them because you can pick your driver or you can pick two competing drivers and you will get to see the numbers between them. And it's just so versatile and it gives you a much greater experience watching Formula One. And I would say if you're on the road, for instance, so you want to follow the qualifying, download the live timing app and watch it through that one because you get all the sector times. It's just much more engaging.
I will say, though, should we have to do that? You know, as fans of the sport, should we have to like work hard to just make watching it interesting for us or exciting for us? Of course, it's nice to have a tailored experience where you can follow one specific driver. Of course, that's nice. But there is a point where you go, well, the production's just kind of not very good, and that's something they should fix, right? I mean, I've watched and engaged with various different types of qualifying formats, and a lot of it does just come down to how it's produced and how it's directed. I mean, is there, for example, like Chris was saying earlier, could we just borrow another format from a different series and just see how it goes, Chris?
No. Because we've seen... No, you don't mess with quality, because we've tried to do it several times and it doesn't work, right? And the trouble is, unless you literally do one-shot quality where everybody has to track to themselves, you're going to have the same problem with the broadcast, regardless of what the format is, right? So in the defense of the broadcasters, you've got, at the start of quality, 20 cars. Even at the end of quality, you've still got 10 cars going out there. What are you going to do? Just have 10 little mini screens all going at the same time? No. I do think there is an opportunity to utilize maybe a bit more picture-in-picture. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they're there to try and tell the story of qualifying. And that, to me, is the job of the commentators.
Okay.
And a lot of the quali is used to kind of sit back and marvel at how great Formula One cars look on TV and just how fast they are, particularly like in the 2019, 2020, when we had the fastest Formula One cars ever produced. We would just sit back and go, wow, that looks absolutely stunning on TV. And that is one of the UPs of Formula One that they try and sell on TV.
Yeah, I think, and it's really nice at the end of quali, I think, when they do the fastest quali lap, whoever's on pole position, they literally turn off the sound and they let you watch the whole lap, listen to the whole lap and see it. And it would just be nice to see a little bit more of that. And yeah, maybe this does open up a little bit more conversation about perhaps, is it a commentary issue? I mean, is there a stylistic difference that could be made? Chris, you are the expert here, but I'm going to... So actually, no, I think you're going to be biased. So I'm going to go to Trumpets for this one.
So as much as I would love to pretend it was all Chris Stevens' fault that quali is now boring for us to watch, in reality, I cannot, because it's really a production issue.
Uh-huh.
Because you should have, at that level, a producer, if not several producers, watching these things and feeding you times and who to watch and who's making mm-hmm. time, who's about to fall out, to help you. Because the amount of information comes very rapidly and it's incredibly mm-hmm. dense. And the thing that I would really be interested to know is, to me, this is the kind of thing it seems like if you wrote the correct custom software for, it could sort of automatically help even those producers point the commentators towards the stories, is that because they're unfolding in 90 seconds and you have five, I mean, oftentimes given the margins now, you have maybe 10 people in play in the first qualifying, you've got mm-hmm. 90 seconds and it's all happening more or less at the same time because they're all following each other. So maybe that's where the focus needs to be. But I do agree, it would be nice to see that improvement happen.
I think you could do a lot with colors. It's a very cheap trick, but the fact that you have cars on not hot laps and you have cars on hot laps, and it's impossible to tell the difference because the ones not on hot lap have to go, 107, 10% within the same time. So as a narrative, you just have a bunch of cars on tarmac, and what is the story here? I think colors, better graphics would do a lot.
But okay, sorry,
but I'm just, even, you know, with the format, it's, they're all doing the laps at the same time because they all know when the best time to be on track is. The only variation you get in that is when a team makes it to Q3, they've only got one set of soft tires. So maybe they do their hot lap while everyone else is heading back to the pits. So that's the only variety you're going to get. So you're always going to have at least, you know, 7, 8, 9, potentially even 10 cars all doing their laps at the same time. Trying to react to that live and following who's going quickest, because you can only react to that and you can only do it either a third or two thirds of the way round the lap. Because mm-hmm. I doubt, well, I'd be 99% certain saying they're not getting the 200 meter mini sector times in the production office. And there are a ton of people in there working out, watching everything going on and saying, I've got this coming up and I've got this, do you want this? And if you remember back to some of the behind the scenes videos that Formula One put out, the best one was how the first lap of Silverstone 2021 unfolded from the production office point of mm-hmm. view. You will see it's just a beautiful orchestrated symphony, right?
Mm-hmm. It's
incredible to watch, right? And so I don't think really there's much more they can do to try and do that. I think the next step will be picture in picture. And to answer the point about the commentators, so I'm not about to sit here and say...
Oh, goodness. Here we go.
I'm not about to sit here and say that Crofty and Alex Jakes, who are much more experienced and more talented than I, are doing a bad job of it. Because
right, I'm going to cut you off here. Right, because I've got the perfect solution to this qualifying issue, because I'm also getting bored of talking about this now. I'm going to summarize it for any F1 producer who happens to be listening. Thing number one, put Chris in the commentary box. He clearly thinks he can do a better job. We'll see how he goes. Baptism by fire. Everyone just be super harsh to him so that, you know, he kind of, if it's good, it's good. If not, then we'll see. And that's clearly not the issue then. And we also need about 10 different cars on screen at once. That would be really great. So if we can get that going, we'll give all of the producers loads of coffee before quali just to make sure that they can keep up with the pace. And what else? I think generally just completely color. Overhaul it. And colours. Okay, so we want colour-coded screens, Chris Stevens commentating, and a complete overhaul of all of the videos that are done. And there you go, Sam. That's how you make quali good.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
And now on to another topic brought up by Ryan Marsh, who has said, love the show, always my first listen on my Monday morning after a race. Good job, Ryan. That's how you meant to do it. Anyway, a couple of questions he's seen floating around online. So he's asked, Alonso showed us how good he is at racing at Brazil. Well, I think he showed us with his two world championships, but after many failed moves to various teams, does he lack the talent to drive a team forward in their development and win championships, drivers and constructors? Alonso is a fantastic, fantastic driver. He's very talented. He's got great racecraft. He knows how to drive the cars. And I think the fact that he's moved from team to team shows that he's adaptable and a good driver at working with a car. But Ryan does raise an interesting point here, which is he's skipped from Alpine to Aston Martin, and neither of the teams have progressed in the way that we were almost promised. I mean, I was rewatching. I'd never watched it before. I was watching Drive to Survive a couple of months ago, and I found it really interesting, the story that followed Alonso at Alpine, which was, we're bringing in this returning world champion. He's got heaps of experience. Very talented guy. He's going to bring the team so far. We've got the car for him. And of course, you know, you've got to put a bit of it in the car. The Alpine was not fantastic, but Alpine didn't make the leaps and bounds with Alonso that they were hoping. And then when Alonso moved to Aston Martin, whilst they had a good start to the season, it's very clear that it's not an Alonso issue. The car has simply dropped off, but there's not a lot of development going with Alonso. So I'll pose the question to our panel. Alonso's a talented driver. He's won 2 world championships, but is he good enough to still be in F1? Matt?
Is he good enough to be in F1? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think there are plenty of drivers that are far worse than him that are also in F1.
You're not wrong.
I would, however, like to take a little premise with our question asker, if I could have that liberty.
Go on, rip Ryan to shreds.
No, you know me. I do enjoy a good Alonso.
Okay.
A dig at Alonso every now and then, but you got to be careful because he does have his fans. But the reality is, I think from a car development point of view, it's very much less driven by the drivers than most people think. It's driven by the engineers and by aero, and the drivers' opinions will get asked at a certain point, or they will explain what they are lacking to the engineers. But that's really an engineer thing. I think where you could legitimately question Alonso and his team skills is asking yourself, does he have what it takes to work with a teammate and win a constructors' championship if they have a car that is there or thereabouts? Because not everybody can work with a teammate.
Like in defense of, you know, Alonso's time at, say, McLaren the second time and Alpine as well, is that, you know, that was team issue, the car not getting any better. And particularly because Alpine just didn't kind of have the funding for it. I know everyone loves to talk about Lewis Hamilton bringing Mercedes, you know, up to the front of the field and helping to produce this dominant car. That's the thing. That car was pretty much, you know, it was already 80% of the way there. Mercedes playing the politics to try and pull up, you know, a big advantage at the start of the turbo hybrid era, which is certainly what they did. And I'm not going to try and underplay Lewis Hamilton's role in making the car better. Mm-hmm. But he didn't, you know, single-handedly pull that team together and say, guys, we're going to go and win the 2014 championship. It's just not how it works.
So
this idea of drivers pulling the team together and pushing them forward and, you know, helping them to create championship winning machinery is in far more nuanced ways, I think, than we ever really anticipate. There's a great chat with Eddie Jordan about how when Damon Hill arrived at the Jordan team, you know, how he knew how to win. And yeah, you know, would make decisions or offer advice. You know, I think the day before they won at Spa, EJ wanted him to go and, you know, be with a sponsor rather than, you know, actually prep for the race. And Damon refused. So there are little things like that. But I think Alonso has made bad career decisions. He's arrived at, you know, decent teams at completely the wrong
Has he
time.
Made bad decisions, though?
Yes, he has, because he left Ferrari on the brink of a return to fighting up at the front of the field. Had Alonso been in that car in 2017, 2018, I'd argue he'd have 2 more world titles to his name, as would Ferrari.
Would you?
Yes, I would.
That's a controversial opinion in itself.
I don't think it is. Maybe 2017 less, because I think that was a bit more car related. But 2018, yes, 100% Alonso would have brought home that championship. Again, he arrived at Alpine and they weren't developing the car properly. Aston Martin have been steered in the wrong direction
for
a variety of reasons. I absolutely think he could still fight for a world championship given the right car.
Well, yeah, but any good driver could in the right car. It's the same debate we always come back to in F1, which is it the driver or is it the car? You know, if you put Lewis Hamilton or Max Verstappen in a Haas, would, you know, don't get me wrong, it wouldn't be winning races, but would they be doing any better? So, Christian, would you say in this debate, in the context of Alonso, is it his fault that he hasn't been doing as well, or is it the car?
It's the car, definitely.
Oh, okay.
I think from a driver perspective, I think he's among the greatest.
Absolutely.
I think he has everything, and he even has the part that is probably not the nicest trait in humans, but he has that. Verstappen has that as well. The top drivers normally have it.
They do.
It's them before others. And it comes to life in different ways. But I think the foundation of the question was, does she have the talent to drive a team forward, right?
Yeah.
And being a boss and being a great driver is two completely different things.
Yeah.
And I think to lead anything in regards to a lot of people beneath you in the structure of the team, you will need to have people gather around you and want to fight for you.
Yeah.
And you can only have that for real if you give that vibe back. And Alonso only thinks about himself, I think, from that perspective.
But doesn't any F1 driver? I mean, I would argue exactly like you said, all of the greats seem to have that selfish string in them. Doesn't every driver want to just do well for themselves?
But if you look at the way this Aston Martin, Red Bull, Alonso going to replace Perez rumor that was going about for a week ago or whatever, that rumor, he went ballistic over it, right? He got mad and there's going to be repercussions. If he was a team leader, he would be going like, what? I'm not leaving my team. This is my team, right? And you never hear Alonso go like that unless he's negotiating some contract. And that you can just see through it. But what I would say is that while I'd argue a team's success will come from the factory and the car and in that direction to the garage, a garage can also make a difference. And Alonso in the start of this season in that Aston Martin garage made a difference in the team.
Well, I would just like to wrap up this Alonso discussion.
Okay.
Because I will apparently get to and say that from a technical point of view, he's more than capable of driving a team to a championship. I think for his side of the garage, he is more than capable of driving a team to the championship. And I think if he is paired with a teammate that he does not view as threatening, he's more than capable of driving a team to a championship. But where I don't see it working for him, and I'm going to go back to that infamous year of 2007, is if he's got a teammate that pushes him too hard, or fights him too much, or whatever it is that gets under his skin in that peculiar way. I don't still, even now, with his increased maturity, I'm not convinced he would be able to handle it well if it was his teammate walking off of the driver's championship and he had to cooperate to get the constructors.
Okay, Chris, just a quick one and then we'll move on.
Yeah, I mean, well, look at his title-winning years in 05, 06, unchallenged by his teammate. The title-challenging years at Ferrari, Massa was nowhere near him. Just a tiny bit of credit there to Formula 4 success for the EJ story I was telling. I couldn't remember the name of their show with DC and EJ, but I've just looked it up, and it's, Formula for Success. And I saw that on their TikTok. It's a great little channel.
Oh, see, everyone, TikTok is the place to be. I wouldn't be here without TikTok. Honestly, if you guys who are watching / listening today are not involved in TikTok, don't worry. I'm aware it is a young person's land and maybe not for everyone, but it's where the cool things happen. So if you want to be cool, get yourself on TikTok. It's not just for us young ones. Okay, my quick point on Alonso. I like him a lot. I think he's a talented driver. I think like any championship winning driver, he's got the attitude for success. To answer your question, Ryan, and to really sum it up, I do not think he lacks the talent to drive a team forward, but it goes so beyond just a driver being able to feed back. But Alonso has the experience and the knowledge to give teams all of the information they need from a driver's end. So if something is missing, I'm not going to blame Alonso. Okay, now let's look forward, shall we, to the coming races of the season, because of course now we're driving towards ever and closer to the end of the season, which is a very sad time for everyone, where all F1 fans curl up in their rooms all winter, not knowing what to do with themselves on a weekend. We all have to find a way to develop a social life somehow, and all of a sudden we can't get out of plans by saying, sorry, we've got the F1. But that is awaiting us. We still have a couple more races left. So let's talk about Vegas. Now, there's been a lot on the social media and in news generally about Vegas, about how suited the F1 cars are going to be to the circuit, how the circuit kind of looks like an upside down pig, how the strip of Vegas has been completely disrupted for months, which I've heard the residents are not too happy about. So sorry to our friends in America, but all in the name of entertainment, and entertainment indeed, because it doesn't sound like the racing is going to be of the best quality, but we'll have to wait and see. The rumour at the moment is that it's a bit chilly, and Jacob Yates has asked us, how do you think the teams will cope with potentially the coldest race on record and one of the longest straights on this year's calendar? Now, we have some considerations with temperature. Obviously, in hotter countries, there's the issue of brakes overheating, of engines overheating. It can be really, really tricky. And we've seen it in recent races where drivers have had to pull out to the side so that they're out of dirty air from the car in front of them just to get some clean, colder air coming through the car. But with a colder track, that presents new challenges, including tyres. Now, I'm going to go to who I know is the most favorite fan of tires ever, Mr. Matt Trumpets. Please, Matt, serenade us with some tire talk.
I would be more than delighted to.
Oh, lucky us.
In fact, well, this is an interesting one. But it did occur to me that we've had testing sessions where it snowed. We have seen cars in cold weather run, but in terms of racing, the closest race I could find, and again, aided by our lovely patrons and the Slack, was the race at Nürburgring, the Eiffel Grand Prix, in, I believe, 2020, where the ambient temperature was 10°C and the track started around 20°C and dropped to 15.
Chilly.
Now, so, but they raced. And they had exactly the kinds of problems that you're going to expect to see here. Namely, some cars, when they went from the soft tire to the medium tire, had issues. And this is not the only track where we've seen this. They just simply had issues getting the tire hot enough to work properly. Now, what's giving everybody a great deal of alarm here is the fact that the ambient temperature in Las Vegas at this time of year runs from like 6 to 10°C.
Very cold. So what is that? What is that in American? In American? In Fahrenheit? Do you work in Fahrenheit?
It's like 38 to 45 maybe.
Okay, I think 38 is where water freezes. So we're talking
32
chilly.
Is where water freezes.
Oh, is it? Okay. Yeah.
Fahrenheit you're talking about. This is new information for me. Fahrenheit.
It's just a different type of measuring temperature.
It's just a better way of measuring temperatures for people.
Mr.
But don't
America.
Worry about
I just
it.
It's an American wave.
Just don't to be inclusive for our listeners who aren't necessarily in the cool parts of the world where we use centigrade.
But this is the point that I want to make about it that I haven't heard anyone make yet, is everyone's been very focused on the ambient temperature and concerned that the tires don't work. But what you also have to understand is that strip of black asphalt will be sitting in a desert sun all day, so that even if the ambient temperature is cold, that track is absorbing a great deal of solar energy and it will be radiating it out. Track temperatures will be dropping. But just by way of comparison, at Brazil, the ambient temperature was 10 degrees cooler in the race than it was in the sprint, but the track temperature was absolutely the same. So it may not be as bad as everyone's worried about once you take into account the fact that as long as it's sunny, the track will probably be much hotter than that as the sun goes down. So they may be able to stay out of what I would think of being the danger zone, where no car can make the tires work at all. Because if those tires don't get hot enough, it really is like driving on ice at that point.
And it is an interesting thing to think about from the team's perspective, at least, with obviously the more cars are on track and the more they're going around, the track heats up a bit. So I think we could see some really interesting stints in quali where, was it Monza in like 2019, 2020, where they all left it till the absolute last minute of quali to go out because that was when the track was optimum. And then they all missed the checkered flag. So it had to default to the Q2 times. I think we could see some of that. Do you think, Chris? I think it could be exciting.
Well, what I'm hoping to see is F1 cars sliding around. Because I think
F1 on ice.
I love watching Formula One cars getting, you know, having less grip and, you know, snaking around a little bit. I think it looks great on TV. I think it highlights the skill of the drivers. It's much more exciting to watch overall. If it were up to me, F1 cars would have an extra 200 brake horsepower, but like a third of the downforce that they have now. And that would be like just beautiful television, right? But what I don't know actually is what the surface of the track is, because have they actually left the original asphalt, or have they done what they normally do with street tracks, which is trying to claim that, oh yeah, we're racing on the public roads when actually we're racing on this temporary new asphalt, which apparently it is. Matt, do you know?
I'm pretty sure. I would want to double check before I bet large sums of money, but I'd be almost certain they've resurfaced, if not all of it, very, very large portions of it.
Yeah, they have, because of all the disruption to the strip that everyone was complaining about.
Okay, so they have done that, then that means it's going to be a darker surface, because if it's brand new, then it's going to be almost like Venta Black, the color of the surface, which means it will absorb a little bit more heat during the day, alluding to Matt's point about it taking up heat during the day. What's funny is that the last time they raced in Vegas in 82 on the Caesars Palace car park was that we had the opposite problem where it was so hot the track was breaking up. So they can never seem to get it right in Vegas.
Well, that's Vegas, baby. That's all the fun and drama, and I guess the teams are just going to have to play the odds on this one. But tyres are always a good subject of talk, and I think it could be an exciting consideration, although I do feel for the fans who are sat still in 6-degree temperatures, Christian.
But I think the race will just be awesome in so many aspects.
Okay. It's going to be riveting. We're going to have good racing. Riveting.
I'm not talking about the racing yet. I just think as an event, I think it will be like a sporting event everyone on the planet will be aware of in the next coming weeks. And it will be something everyone talks about. It will be a major thing. Wait till you see the headquarters for Liberty and stuff. It's going to be like the first time they released the Abu Dhabi track to end the season. That was also a major thing. There was also going to be a lot of people who just hate it, find it ridiculous, I guess, because it's a bit overdone from some aspects. Yeah, but I think in a few years' time, it will find its form on the calendar as a flagship race, a bit like Austin was at first. But one thing I think is for sure is everyone's going to complain about the tires, and I think that will be it's just reality for Formula One these days. When you go to a track with 5 degrees ambient temperatures, and you have these tires that has such a high tire pressure and are just skidding around a bit, and everyone's like experimenting still with the skidding around. It's probably not going to be the most fun race for the drivers.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the drivers, of what we've heard in interviews at least, have said we're super excited to go, mainly because of the excitement and the splendor that's all around it. It's all about celebrating the glitz and the glamour of F1, which, especially in the new era when we're trying to be appealing to an American audience a little bit more and appealing to this new generation of F1 watchers, I think it'll be really great to have a race like that where you look forward to it just because it's Vegas, kind of like with Monaco, where you go and it's such an F1 classic and everyone is so excited for it, not because we're going to see loads of overtakes, because we're not in denial, but because it's a classic. And I do think that Vegas has the capacity for that in the future.
I think it doesn't really matter how good the race is, because it's being promoted and organized by Liberty Media, who, if you've forgotten, are the owners of Formula One. So is here to stay for a while. Mm-hmm. And if you're wondering why it's being talked about than any other race in the world, yeah, you know, aside from their attempts to make it the biggest sporting event of the year, I mean, that is why.
I have to say, it hasn't really worked, though, because, I mean, put your hand up if you've been looking forward to Vegas all season. Not one single hand was raised, dear reader. Not one. I mean, they've hyped it up so much, and I completely understand it, because they're trying to make it a race that celebrates the glitz and the glamour, like I said. But something about it hasn't worked. I mean, when they put tickets out, for example, to begin with, I think someone said the average weekend ticket price was $7,000. And now, if you look on the website, because there are still many tickets available if anyone happens to be in the Vegas area, you can get a whole weekend pass for something like $300. So there's going to be a few empty seats at this rate. It's looking a little bit sad so far, but I think we can all look forward to it. It'll be something a little bit different. And we might have the capacity for some future excitement there.
And now, as befitting my absolutely prehistoric age, I would like to answer the following reader question most succinctly, sent to us by Remo Elo. He's asking, why do we think there's never been a race in Scandinavia or Finland? And should we have a race there? And I have to, at this point, draw on my ancient well of knowledge while ignoring the offended looks of Christian Peterson and say, indeed, there was a Swedish Grand Prix from 1973 to 1978. It came about because Ronnie Peterson, Swedish driver, had been quite successful. And the reason I wanted to mention this, and the only reason I wanted to mention this, is two of the highlights. One, it was the only win for the six-wheel Tyrrell car at the Swedish Grand Prix, and I believe it was 76. And then in 78, it was the only appearance in Formula One at all of the infamously famous Brabham fan car, which won the race after the track surface got slippery with oil. All the other cars had to slow way down, and the fan car just drove like there was nothing at all wrong with the track. And that's perhaps why they never raced it again, because it would have been called illegal. Anyway, so should they have it again? Yeah, sure, if they can get a grade one track.
Okay, Christian, go on, put your European opinion forward.
Well, no Danish Grand Prix. I need to get my breath first. Yeah, I am. Okay.
For reference, for anyone who can't see Christian right now, he's got a really forlorn look on his face. He's crying. He's holding his chest. He's very upset. F1, what are you doing? Get us in the land of the Danes.
It all started in 61. It was held at Roskilde Ring, which is placed in a town called Roskilde, which is where the Magnussons are from. The track was 1.4 kilometers long, which is less than a mile. There was no straights. There was a lot of bank corners, and there was 40,000 Danes there watching. And one ticket was 50 cents. Half a dollar, I think, and Stirling Moss and Jack Brabham both raced both years, and they respectively won. But at that point in time in Formula One, it was so unorganized. So you that particular years, they had only 8 races on the official Formula One calendar, but all the Formula One drivers went to all sorts of different races and did their both in F1 and F2. And this Danish Formula One race was with all the Formula One races, but it wasn't part of the official Formula One calendar. So, you could theoretically say that we haven't had a Grand Prix in Denmark. But I challenge you, Romain Oilo. What?
Okay, right. Let's end this debate then. Chris, are we bringing a Scandinavian Grand Prix to F1? Do we do it or not?
So there is... Yeah, there is a grade one track in Finland called the Kimi Ring. It's not Kimi as in Kimi Räikkönen, it's spelled K-Y-M-I. And it was built a couple of years ago, it was opened, but it was made for MotoGP. So probably the safety standards exceed what is needed for Formula One. But I would put forward, is rallying not a more popular form of motorsport in the Scandinavian region? And that is kind of the big ticket motorsport out there.
I don't know, Christian, is rallying a big thing?
Well, rally is a bit like family would rally cross. And I would say those two things are probably the most popular, but that is because they're approachable. The cars are cheap.
Okay, so it's an accessibility thing.
Oh, rallying is not a thing, really. It's we do have good drivers, but it's, I mean.
I literally thought that was just how you commuted to work.
Yes, you must cross this icy valley.
I can't speak for the Finns, though. I mean,
here we go.
And I'm saying this with the biggest heart of all, but the Finns are strange people in the best way.
Okay, heavy on the in the best way. We love everyone here on Missed Apex podcast.
Every time I meet a Finn anywhere in the world, I love them. And yeah, but I'm pretty sure everyone will say this about Finns. They are not like other people. They are themselves in every different... they are all a little bit like Kimi Räikkönen.
Oh, and can't that only be a good thing? I love Kimi. Whoa.
It is a good thing. They are original. They are maybe a little bit... I know you can't generalize, but every time I've met a Finn, I've loved them, but they've been really introvert in the best way.
Okay, well then maybe F1, I mean, for those who might not necessarily know, grade one is achieved by a circuit from fulfilling various criteria, and F1 will only race on a grade one rated circuit, just because it comes with various things like asphalt quality, various safety things that make it compatible not just for F1 but for F1 safety standards. So when we're looking at various circuits that could be raced at by F1, they have to be grade one listed, which does mean it narrows down a lot of the searches. So yeah, if we could get to Scandinavia, that would be great, make it even more of a world championship. But I suppose we do have to draw the line somewhere. We can't be going to every single country, as I think that might take a little bit of a while. How many countries are there, like 273? Something
282.
200. Well, like there you go. Well, as much as I would love a daily Grand Prix, I think it would lose its.
The Vatican City Grand Prix. That's what.
Oh my gosh! Can we get the Pope Mobile involved for the drivers doing their like little laps? The
safety car.
Oh my goodness! We've just started something, guys. Guys. Oh my goodness.
Well, that's the.
Oh, right. F1, this is for you. We want this. I'm going to start a petition. Dear listeners, you expect to receive an email from me in the next couple of days, and I would appreciate your signatures. I want the Pope Mobile as the safety car, and I want it going around with the Pope doing blessing babies and doing nice waves to, because it would be lovely. Cultural aspect. Guys, we've got something here. We actually have got something.
If you're watching this. If you're watching this on TikTok, because I've no doubt this bit is going to end up on TikTok now, let us know in the comments.
Oh my goodness, right. So I would like my request for next season. All I want is I want a Vatican City Grand Prix, and I want the safety car to be the Pope in his Pope Mobile. End of. So on the subject of Scandinavia, we have a listener called Adam Danish who's written in to us. Like, that's so great. That was really professional, wasn't it? As a newer F1 fan, I've loved listening to the podcast these past couple of years. Thank you, Adam. I've got maybe a stupid question. Don't worry, there's no such thing. But how do some F1 corners get their nickname? Silverstone seems to be the king of this. So, for example, Maggots and Beckett's being one he thinks about a lot. Do any of us have a favourite corner name or favourite memory of a certain corner? Right, I'm going to... None of you talk. I want this one. I want this one first. I'm jumping in. So, one of my favourite things about F1 is the... Well, one of the things that comes up most for me being in a social media space is gatekeeping. There's so much of it in the sport with, oh, you're not a real fan. Name who was the 1973 world champion. And I hate gatekeeping. It sucks. It's awful. But one thing I will always gatekeep is knowing your corner names for your circuits. It's the way you know a top fan from a casual listener. And there's nothing wrong with a casual listener, but I know who I'm talking to if I go, oh, yeah, no, they're just going around cops right now. Because I know I get some funny looks when I'm on... I'll go like sim racing or something, and I'll be talking through my lap on Silverstone, and they'll go, how do you know all this? Because I went and I learned it and I revised it. It's a rite of passage for all F1 fans. Now, right, put your hands down. I'm not done.
Right.
So, for example, we look at Silverstone. Silverstone only has one corner. This is a fun fact. Silverstone only has one corner that's actually named after the way it looks. So unlike a corner like Parabolica at Monza, where it's shaped like a parabola, a curve, hence the name, Silverstone only has the loop, and that's the only name on the circuit that's after the shape. But there's other corners, for example, Stowe, named after the nearby Stowe School, a very famous private school. It's named according to local landmarks. We've got the Wall of Champions in Canada, where I think about six different world champions have stacked it into this wall on a chicane. It's a rite of passage, in my opinion. Or is it passage? Am I being northern right now? Is it passage? Is it passage? Am I being silly? Anyway, I have a northern father, and sometimes these isms slip out. So, yeah, I know it's horrible. Spanners is like going, oh, gross, in the background for anyone who can't hear him. But I'm going to go to the panel now. Iconic corners, some of these. Absolutely iconic. And iconic for a reason, for example, Wall of Champions. What's your favorite? Go trumpets.
Right, so I wish to disagree with your entire premise.
Unacceptable.
The corners are numbered, and drivers and engineers only refer to the numbers when they talk to each other. And if we're going to talk about where the names for Silverstone came from, it could be basically described as things we found laying on the ground near here. If you go through all of the turns, and I guess we include turns like Parabolica, oh, it looked like a bird that I saw flying past. So I call it that. The names are for the commentators. The names are for the fans. But you do not have to learn the names to be a fan of Formula One.
That's not what I said. I will not go down as a gatekeeper. I will not. I will clarify my point. Chris, I know you're waving your hand, right? Be patient. I'll be with you in a second. I will not say that you to qualify as a fan, you need to know your corner names. I'm just saying it's an important rite of passage. Everyone has to sit looking at a circuit map and go, oh, is this Maggots or Beckett's? Because I've been through it. We all have to go through it. Chris.
Yeah, I love how Matt started his point by saying, oh, well, drivers only use numbers, so you're an idiot for using corner names, and then ended his point with, but you should be a fan if you want to know.
I don't think I called anyone an idiot for using numbers or names.
You did. You said it specifically. Look, I love corner names. I love corner names. I love the history of where they get them from. And, you know, Matt is right. 99% of corner names are just whatever they're next to. You know, for example, at the first corner at Monaco is named after the chapel. Or they're named after people of significance. So same track at Monaco, Anthony Noakes. Going back to places, there's the Fairmont Hotel.
Yeah, exactly.
So Fairmont Hairpin, or whatever that hotel's called now. It's had three different names over the last 60 odd years. So I like the ones with a bit of backstory to them as well, like Eau Rouge,
sure.
Right, very famous. Red River, because of the Red River that runs under the circuit there, right? So people of significance, or they get named after a driver.
Yes, and that's a lovely touch. Yeah.
Yes. So you have Ascari at the Senna Monza, for example. You have the Senna S's, the Hamilton Straight now as well. I'm sure there are others that I'm not remembering. I would love to do a show dedicated to every corner name in Formula One and how
and
they got their name.
Every listener just fell asleep
immediately.
You know what, Chris? You've lost your talking rights. Christian?
So this just in. Originally, the corners at the Spa was named after European cities.
Oh, wow.
So when they built the track back in, I think, early 70s or maybe late 60s, so corner 9, which is the interesting corner on Spa, was originally called... I'm going to wait with the original.
What's it called now? Just so we all know which one you're talking about.
It's called Jaggy X.
Oh, you mean Speaker's Corner?
Yeah, or Rivage 2. So it's been known as Speaker's Corner because I think it was where the speaker was back in the days for all the fans there.
No, it was the only, like, apart from Eau Rouge and, like, the main straight, it was the only corner you could see from the commentary box.
Ah, that was how, yeah. And then it was called Rivage 2 because it was after Rivage. And then it's most famously been called No Name for some strange reason. And now it's officially been named Jaggy X. But back in the day when they built the track, this corner was actually called Copenhagen, which is funny because I'm from Denmark. So we can laugh now.
I like corner names. I think they add something to a circuit. And you know a circuit is a classic when it's got the corner names. Something to me, it really appeals to me as a fan. You know, you feel like you're coming home to Spa, you know, with La Source into Eau Rouge, into Radeon. It's all beautiful. And it's feel there's something so classic about it that I think really adds to the character of a circuit.
No, okay. I can't agree with that at all. There are nice ones at Silverstone as well. Obviously, they got Brooklands, which is named after the Brooklands circuit, which is the oldest racetrack in the world, I think it is, certainly in the UK. There are nice ones, I mean, Aintree, very similar as well. And then you've got, like, Hangar Straight as well, because Silverstone used to be a World War II, like, airfield. So it was named after the hangars, and then you've got Wellington Straight, named after the Wellington bombers that they used to house there as well. So I like the fact that you get this sense of history, and it's why really only the older circuits tend to have this, because they've been around for, you know, 40, 50, 60 odd years. The ones I'm really unfamiliar with, though, are the ones at Zandvoort. I really need to learn more of those. And I will pitch to Spanners during the off season to do a corner naming show, regardless of how you feel about that, Antonia.
Just a small comment on that. I think one thing we forget about this is when you have those local names, it brings a lot to the story. So if you watch Tour de France, for instance, 80% of the story is just commentators talking about where we are now, the red wine, yada yada yada. And we need this, like, heritage when we go to a track. Las Vegas is one thing. But when we go to the old classical tracks, all the history that it brings, I think a lot of that is in the names and in the things we remember, or the accidents happening around some name that is locally by it.
Mm-hmm. We'll tie this up. But before we do, from this question, I would like to know, just to answer Adam Danish's question, do we have a favorite corner or a favorite memory at a corner? So I'm going to go in first. For me, it's Eau Rouge Radeon. It's a bucket list thing for me to go to Spa and watch the race from Eau Rouge. It's, for me as a fan, that is the one thing where if I don't go to a race in my life, the one I'd be most devastated not to go to would be Spa. And I would want to sit at Eau Rouge. And for me, it's just the most iconic, of course, not necessarily in the best way, given its history with accidents. But I love it. So let's go through the panel. Chris, your favorite or most memorable corner?
So just on the Eau Rouge, as somebody who has been up Eau Rouge, climbed up it earlier this year on my first visit to Spa, it is a rite of passage. The first time you go to Spa, you should find some time, if possible, to try and get up Eau Rouge. I tried to do the same thing at Monza with the banking, couldn't quite squeeze that in. I was very annoyed at myself. But anyway, and yes, it is true that when you're going up it, all you can see is sky and the tops of trees. Wonderful, right? But in terms of, I'm looking at this in which ones do I like doing on the sim the most when I'm doing iRacing. That, to me, because Eau Rouge is just easy flat these days, right? Even in, you know, GT machinery, since it got reprofiled, it's just flat now. I would say Puan. Same track, but for me, I'd love in the sim when you're approaching Puan and you just do that little lift and then chuck it in back on the power. You try and hang on to it for as long as possible. It's so satisfying when you get it right.
Okay, so Chris is putting himself in driver's shoes. Matt, are you going to do the same? What's a corner that you're particularly fond of?
Well, I was going to say, I think from a watching point of view, the S's at Suzuka remain one of favorite things to observe. Mm-hmm. However, as a driver, and as a driver who's actually driven the circuit, I'm going with Maggots and Becketts. And it's because on one of my not as many as I wanted laps in an actual race car, I got to that left-hander and I thought, there's no way I'm going to get, like, I'm going too fast. Mm. While the person in the other seat was yelling at me, "Turn more!" And I did, and the car just stuck. It was astonishing. And it was my first lesson. Pip Hammond,
thank you, Pip,
friend of the show.
Love that guy.
Awesome driver. Excellent, excellent builder of race cars. And multi-champion in 750 MC.
Classic stock hatch.
Chris,
it was.
Was that where you started your commentating? That's certainly where you started your reporting.
It's where I was reporting. I wasn't commentating just then yet. But Pip actually has been on the mic with me at our own karting events.
This is true. This is true. And it was my first lesson in how much the difference is between the performance of a car built to race and a car that you drive on the roads. And for that reason, it will always stick with me. So anyone who goes through there flat, yeah, impressive.
Okay. Okay. This is good. Christian, are you also going to offer a driver's perspective?
I don't care about the names, really. So for me, it's definitely a driving perspective. And if you can get the S's at Suzuka right, I'm not sure there's anything more rewarding. But it is also a combination of corners, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you can get that right, and I'm only talking sim, of course, mm-hmm. it's a very, very rewarding feeling. But T1 in Suzuka as well has some of the same, the speed you put into there, and T2, I mean, just that entire combination of corners is legendary.
I have to agree. Chris, very quickly.
Just in terms of like what has the best name, like some of the ones at the Nordschleife, where you do actually have to, you know the corner names. You can't go in, oh yeah, at turn 126, the car was oversteer. So there are some good ones like the Foxhole, which is because there was a fox that like died in a part of the circuit when it was being... during the construction. And then there's ones like named after local monks or like local gallows. There's like so much history in that. If you've got like a spare 10 minutes, Google the names of the Nordschleife corners and where they get the names from.
Oh, well, guys, that's very interesting. And it's nice to always hear everyone's opinions on this. So please, if you have a favorite corner or a favorite memory of a corner, please do let us know. You can drop it in the comments here. You can just send us an email, have a chat with us on feedback@missedapex.net. And of course, if you would like one of your questions to be answered, also you can use that email address to get in and we'll, I'm sure, have some very exciting debates with you. But that is going to be all from us for tonight. Thank you very much for coming and listening and spending some time with us, whether it's on your Monday morning commute, live on YouTube, or any other time. I think, as Spanners always says, work hard, be kind, and have fun. We'll try our best to do so too. This has been Missed Apex.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.